their fleshy outer covering, muscles that now enabled him to have a bold, strong grip, as if modified with tensile cables of steel. The liver spots of artificial age, thrust cruelly upon his weathered skin, had vanished. His threadbare garments, trousers, shirt, coat, all were also whole and new. The felt of his black frock coat was brushed and unfrayed. The leather of his boots crinkled like new brown paper and shone like wet vinyl in the flickering flames. Flames? A tall stovepipe hat stood erect on his head. The Doc couldn't recall wearing such a chapeau more than once or twice, and even then, only because the headgear was a gift, and he'd never liked the thing, feeling that it made a mockery of him, and goodness, but wasn't it terribly hot in this latest splotch of mind vomit? The shock of returned youth fell away as Doc realized he was surrounded by fire.
By the three Kennedys!
His own voice in his ears was like freshly thrown thunder. He'd have to speak loud and plain to be heard here. A chemstorm was brewing, flashing pink lightning against the darkness of the night sky. The air smelled acidic and alien, like the laboratories of his college days. And then he knew. He remembered this place. It was Snakefish, California, a mere scrap of a once prosperous state, decimated by the sub-launched nuclear missiles from Soviet submarines off the West Coast. It was the home of Baron Edgar Brennan, who'd either taken or been given the comical name of a long-dead folksy cowboy actor, according to Mildred Wyeth. The physician had heard of Edgar and his Strangeville secondhand, since she was still in cryosleep during the time of that adventure, but Doc had assured her she hadn't missed much. Baron Brennan had set himself up in high style thanks to a hidden cache of gasoline, but he was an old man, and in a tale as ancient as the world, youth overtook age. His subjects in Snakefish had turned against him. Ultimately, he died with his face in the dirt, shot in the back by a sawed-off shotgun. A double-barreled charge of death that nearly cut him in two, chilling him messily, if not instantly. Way of the world. A baron fell, another rose to take his place. Like a well-swung scythe aimed at tall stalks of wheat in the field, if they were cut down, more would come back. Patterns within patterns. They... Ryan, Doc, J.B., Jack, Christy, Lori, and that other poor unfortunate, Rick Ginsburg. All of them were at the fuel refinery, where the gasoline that kept the Baron in power was processed. Three large storage tanks were sticking up tall against the backdrop of the mountains. A score of rocking donkey pumps bobbed up and down in patient, unchanging motion. Great metal monstrosities bringing up the thick crude and sending it into a long warehouse-like building, where the actual refining and processing of the gas were accomplished. There were several low walls, but only one possible entrance into the complex. Ryan had chosen this as the locale of their final stand against the new Baron and his followers, using the site's allure to bring in their foes, even as the companions fled out the back. Behind them, a stream of refined gasoline was gaining speed, the oily stench of fuel hanging in the air. Jack had opened all of the main valves on the three oversized fuel containers, and now thousands of gallons of gas were flooding through the complex, along the roadway, and toward their murderous pursuers. The hot exhaust from one of their foes' chrome and leather-enhanced Harley-Davidson motorcycles ignited the released fuel into an explosion of cataclysmic proportions. The wretched bill of Snakefish was burning. The worshippers of the giant sand serpents went up in flames, abandoned by their reptile god, to twist in the heated wind. Time to go. Smoke hung in the air, and Doc felt himself cough as he tried to take in a fresh breath. Thick black smoke billowed around him like a hot fog, an ashen blanket draped around his shoulders.
Run, damn it!
The cry came out of the fire. Who had issued the order? Ryan? Yes, that was the voice of command the One-Eyed Leader wielded so well, motivating all of them past death again and again. And there she was, running as fast as she could across the withered pavement, her blonde hair shining like a beacon, glowing brighter in the light of the fires. Lori Quint, a 17-year-old beauty with a body like a newborn colt, all legs and stumbling, running for her life, her high-heeled boots of tooled red leather slapping down on the road. A 17-year-old with a woman's body but the mind of a much younger girl. Even as a man in his mid to late 30s, and truth be told, that was his real biological age, Doc felt a twinge of cradle-robbing when enraptured in the throes of passion with Lori. He was a man who appeared and acted over 60 years old, and she wasn't his lover in appearance, but more of a daughter. During his earlier lifetime in the late 1800s, one of Doc's wealthier friends from Oxford had arrived at the local men's club on a weekly basis with a new young woman on his crooked arm. His nieces, he called them, with a nudge and a wink.
Theophilus, come over here, you scowling brigand, and meet my niece.
Doc had smiled, allowing his colleague to present his lie to everyone's amusement. It was harmless enough, since the man's wife had been dead 7 years, and his children, now adults, with their own love affairs to conduct. It wasn't until after Lori was dead, her nubile frame engulfed and turned to ash by the firestorm, that Doc realized that though he grieved for her, he hadn't loved the girl. Oh, he'd cared for her, and sought comfort in her arms, in her embrace, in their lovemaking. She'd made him feel alive once more, whispering his name, shuddering with pleasure at his touch. Even as she'd later chisel away at his self-esteem by pointing out her own vitality against the damages of time inflicted on his body. She'd taken the young Joshua Mote as her lover, allowing Doc and Ryan to catch her in the midst of a particularly randy bit of sex. She'd offered no explanation for her illicit affair, no apology to the man she'd wronged. A woman had needs, Doc knew that, but a woman should also have decency and compassion. And his sexual equipment and plumbing worked just fine, thank you very much. At that moment in time, his eyes filled with the sight of her betrayal. Doc had never missed his wife so much. Lori Quint. She'd been headstrong, that one, with the unproved wisdom and brazenness of youth. One moment, she was as valuable an ally as could be hoped for in the Deathlands, quick to protect herself and her companions by firing off 22 caliber rounds from her pearl-handled PPK. Other times, however, a darkness revealed itself behind her laughing eyes. She'd backtalk Ryan or pick verbal fights with Christy. She'd ignore JB's advice and Doc's pleading and plunge headlong without regard for what might be hiding around the corner. Behind her, the yellow and orange and red petals of the onrush of fire opened like an expectant flower. But this was no inviting garden bud. This was a serpent of flame. The tall blonde girl was silhouetted against the towering wall of yellow-orange fire as it swept toward her, hot tongues of flame licking at her boot heels.
My sweetness, my lovely fawn.
Doc's pet names were cruelly ironic as he watched the flames engulf the girl, watched helplessly as she fell and melted within the fringes of the inferno. Then he could watch no more as his eyes filled with tears of regret and loss. So close. How many had died? First his beloved children, and then Emily, and now his newly found angel, Lori. Next, the entire world and almighty man and his loves and hates and accomplishments and regrets. All dead. All dead. And as for the good Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner, hell, old Doc just kept on living. Perhaps he'd still be doddering around at the end of time, perched on the arid edge of eternity, the tails of his faded frock coat flapping around his legs in the buffeting winds as the universe finally wound to a stop. What good was his regained youth now? Doc stood above an ocean of time and was amused to discover that the color of temporal fluid and mass was a wickedly shimmering blue. He reached up with a hand.
Boo-hoo, blue hue, toodaloo to you.
The age spots had returned. Doc smiled wistfully, pulled the string to the single blue bulb hanging from the ceiling overhead, and turned out the light. Darkness.
Without a doubt, that sucked.
Ryan opened his eye. Above, the hexagonal configuration of metallic discs housed in the ceiling fixtures of yet another Matrans unit shone down impassively on him. The massive amounts of energy sent surging through them mere seconds before, now spent and fading away. Ignoring the sensation of nausea, Ryan turned his face to the wall and found himself looking at a new color of armaglass. The jump had been successful. The dingy gray walls of the North Carolina redoubt were gone, left behind and forgotten. The jump dream was still fresh in JB's mind, as his own paint voice offered up a mirror of Mildred's.
Takeoffs aren't the problem. It's the landings.
What color is this, anyway?
Ryan gestured toward the armaglass wall,